Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, you're listening to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Hello, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, the creator, producer, and co-host of the show. And today we have a Health Data Palooza special for you. Yesterday, we concluded the fifth annual Health Data Palooza, a term coined by none other than Todd Park, the CTO of the U.S. government, chief technology officer of the U.S. government. Health Data Palooza is organized by the Health Data Consortium, and we just wound up a rather interesting session here. And on the broadcast today, my co-host, Dr. Phil Marshall, chats with his colleague, Dr. Danny Sands, and we'll dig into the fertile ground of startup health, the Startup Health Showcase, and entrepreneurialism, including other patient data access issues and more. So with that, let me turn it over to you, Phil, for the introduction of Dr. Danny Sands.
All right. Well, it's great to be with you again, Greg, and indeed sitting with me in his living room. Actually, I'm visiting with Dr. Danny Sands, who is so well known as a patient advocate, an expert in patient engagement, a physician. He is a faculty member at Harvard, and on faculty at Beth Israel Deaconess, where he takes care of patients. And has one patient that we all know well in the social media realm, and that's e-patient Dave DeBroncart. So he certainly has had a great deal of experience, and we both are just now emerging from Health Data Palooza and Startup Health. And so welcome, Danny.
Thank you, Phil. It's a pleasure to be here. Oh, wait, this is my home.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Thank you. thank you for having me. So we didn't talk that long ago on This Week in Health Innovation, and we covered a variety of topics, trends, and things that are happening in the market, certainly from a patient engagement perspective, which is increasingly popular. But what I'd like to talk about is really more the topic of the day and this very timely issue coming off of Health Data Palooza. You and I both participated in the Startup Health event, which happened in parallel with Health Data Palooza. And I should mention for our audience also that the folks who run Startup Health, we are planning to have them as our guests here on This Week in Health Innovation, Stephen Krein and Unity Stokes. And so we're looking forward to having them as an upcoming guest. And so we'll get more of a deep dive about all things that are happening in Startup Health when we have them on. But coming off of Health Data Palooza, there was a lot of energy, a lot of excitement. Certainly was the largest Health Data Palooza that we've had. In fact, I just read that they had 66 million impressions of the hashtag HDPalooza. My understanding is that Danny was using the wrong hashtag for the entirety of the conference, and so that easily could have reached 80 million, I'm sure.
I'm a nonconformist, so.
He was truly outside of the loop on that one. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things. First of all, the discussion the discussions that you were part of, the topics that you heard people chatting about and having the most energy about, that's one thing. But at the same time, and perhaps ironically, another big thing happened when it comes to health data access and consumers managing their health, and that is that Apple unveiled their iOS 8 with HealthKit. And so I'd like to also talk about the intersection of consumer devices and people being able to more easily channel their data into a common device that they have easy access to and how that's going to play into the ecosystem. So let's talk about all of those things. We've only got a half an hour. You and I could talk about all that for days. So let's start with this. Health Data Palooza I know that you certainly weren't in all the events, but you had a number of conversations with some of the real influencers there. And we know that Todd Park, for instance, talked about some of the greatest trends that he is focused on as the Chief Technology Officer of the United States. And one of those is and continues to be patient access to their own health information. I attended the Blue Button Plus work group, which is all about patient access to their health information. And you, as really the creator of many of the standards around patients being able to email their doctor, and you've been at the forefront of policy and guidance in that area, let me sort of get your reaction after Health Data Palooza. Where do you feel that patient access to their own health information sort of fits within sort of that level of excitement and what people are talking about coming off of a big conference like this?
Yeah, Phil, I think that certainly Todd's statement of data liberación is very, very important, liberating the data that has not been accessible. And I think initially Todd was really talking about information that the government sort of had locked up. But it's sort of that concept has been extended to any data about patients that could be accessible to them, and we can make that accessible, make that data liquid. And I think that's a very important concept. So I'm going to talk first. I want to talk first for a moment about why I think it's important, and then I'm going to talk about why I think there's perhaps why perhaps people are this is not going to fix all of our problems. Let's put it that way. So it is crucially important that if we want to provide, if we want to make it a world in which patients are more engaged in their health and healthcare, because we know that leads to better outcomes, and we know that leads to better satisfaction, lower costs. So it's all the things that we want. It's the triple aim, if you will. It will help us there if patients are more engaged in their health. It is not the case that making data available to patients will all of a sudden achieve those goals. It is true, however, that there are patients who want to be engaged and involved in their health. And for those patients, we need to lower the barriers or decrease the friction in helping them, in having them get involved in their health. And that has many dimensions to it. One of the dimensions is making it easy for them to get access to the healthcare system. So whether that's making it easy for them to make an appointment or get a prescription renewal or get a referral to a specialist, all those things are really important. It's also access to information, and it's also access to their record and to communications with their healthcare team. But let's focus on the access to the record for a second. I think that's a very important thing, and as you know, Phil, that we let our patients at Beth Israel Deaconess access all their health information back starting in the year 2000. So it's been almost 15 years that we've been doing this, letting them have access to all their test results, their medications, their problems. And that was really exciting and important when we did that. Now it's becoming more common. So we know that, and we were talking about this earlier, it is, more people than ever have access to their health information online.
And they have access to that information across the continuum, not just from a single provider, especially as you look at systems like Kaiser and other integrated systems that have used Epic and MyChart. The footprint there is really quite large, where patients have access to really the complete health record, or at least a great extent of it. And so one of the things that you and I were chatting about earlier, and you know, Danny, that in 1998, I started sort of a personal evangelism as part of the personal health record push.
Yes.
That Google and Microsoft were most famous for, but we did a lot of work at WebMD to have that kind of capability that underlied a lot of the employer and payer capabilities that they offer. And so I was a big proponent. We were, I think, both part of the Connecting for Health initiative, mm-hmm. that did some of the early work in identifying.
Through the Markle
Foundation. That's right, through the Markle Foundation, that did some of the early work in, first of all, highlighting the desire by consumers and the need for consumers to have access to that data. But as you say, we're now 15 years into your own deployment of that capability. We now have upwards of perhaps 80 million Americans, 100. I've heard a variety of different stats on how many people have access to their health information online from their provider. And so my question is going to be point blank. What's been the value that we've realized as a result of that? We've theorized about the value. We talked about it. We pushed for it. We've got a lot of evangelism out there still for giving people their data, liberate their data. But still people don't have access to their data, and we recognize that as a problem. But we theorized about so much value that would come from it. What have we actually realized as a result of it?
So let me make two comments. First of all, not everybody wants access to their health data. And more importantly, not everyone wants to be engaged in their health. I wish that they did, but not to minimize the importance of this, Phil, but I think we have to recognize there's some patients who are going to be very hard to engage in their health no matter what tools we give them. But I do think that the kind of tools we were talking about, communication, information, data access, and so on, these things lower barriers for those patients who do want to engage and patients who are on the fence about engaging. But for those patients who do want to engage, who do want access to information, we have to ask what that means. So it is not true that if someone says, yeah, I have access to my health record online, that they really have access to their health record. They may have access to their test results, for example. They may have access to their medication list. But you know what? They really don't have access to everything. And even within an institution, within a network, they may have access to the elements I talked to you about, but the real value, the real content of a record is not in those bits and bytes. It's really in the clinical narrative. It's in those clinical notes. And very few institutions today still let patients access their complete record, including the notes. Now, as you know, Beth Israel Deaconess was one of several centers involved in a multi-center trial of letting patients have access to their notes. It was called Open Notes. And you can go to myopennotes.org and read about that. But tremendous research done there by the team showing that it's really a good thing for patients to have access to their notes, and it adds a lot of value to them.
Well, maybe it's my PHR scar tissue coming through here.
Yes.
Okay? But you know, let's say that one-fifth, maybe as few as one-tenth, truly have access to their health records online. Okay?
Okay,
let's just make that argument. There's some portion of Americans that do. Let's say it's one-fifth, one-tenth. What you just said is that, but not all people do, right? We still have more to go. Now, there's no doubt about that. But my devil's advocate in me says, but we have a big chunk now that do. And I'm wondering, after all of this time, 15 years in your case, less so for some others, although Kaiser Permanente, you know, implemented KP Online starting in 1996, I think, 1997. But that wasn't
access to their health records.
Well,
it
soon included access to their health records. So my point is this. We have a chunk of Americans that have access to their full health records. It's not a small number of people that do. Okay, and what I'm wondering is, you know, I went to the Blue Button session at Health Data Palooza. Everybody there believes the same thing. We were there because we believe in the access of people to their health data. There's certainly a shared point of view there. However, I continue to hear that we're doing surveys that prove that Americans see value in having access to their health record. We started the session with personal stories about me not having or someone not having access to their records and what it meant to have to go through that process, the same kinds of things that we heard 15 years ago.
Yeah.
We now have a chunk of people that have access to their health records, and I'm wondering, what have we learned about the value, or is the theoretical value that we hypothesize about not being realized? What's really happened?
Well, I would argue that one can't achieve a lot of value if you only have access to a part of your record. So that's really important. And there are two aspects of that. One is what I just mentioned, that you may have access to a piece of your record, but not your whole record, within an institution. Now, it gets even worse than that, because most people aren't at Kaiser. Most people don't get their care just in one healthcare system. And so what we have actually is a multi-provider problem, that if I, as a patient, am having to get my care in different places, some of those places may have a portal, some of them may not. But in fact, for me as a patient to aggregate that information from different sites, even if they all have a portal, is making it difficult for me. But let's forget about those two big issues, which is that not all patients really have access to all their health information, even those that say they have access. Okay, so let's move on. What is the value? And I think that information You know,
and don't stick to the theoretical value.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at what the value has been for those, even if it's a relatively small subset, for those who have had access to their whole record.
So this is something that is being studied and has been studied, and I can't tell you chapter and verse the literature, but it's, you know, people I think are running surveys. They're trying to find out through focus groups as well what people are getting out of it. And I will say that, although I can't cite the research in this area, there is a value in patients seeing the results of their actions so that they can, you know, find out, gee, I wasn't following my diet, and look what happened to my numbers.
Mm. Okay? So pattern recognition.
Pattern
the
recognition
ability
is important.
That the more data that you have, the more complete it is, and the more long-term it is, the patterns can be recognized to be able to identify causation.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on the right track?
That's right. And there's more. So having a record of my medications, for example, you know, I don't remember what my medications are. Let's get a look at that medication list, because I want to know what that is. Having access to that is, I think, really important. I'm knowing my allergy list. I don't remember what that drug is that I'm allergic to. I can find that information. I can download that information if I'm on a blue button tool. So I can utilize that information. I think all that information, so it's referential, it's identification of trends and associations that may be important to my health, and it may be sharing that information with others with whom I'm getting care. So you're going on vacation this summer or in the fall, and you're going to you may want to have access to your record from there so that you can share it with providers in the event that you should get sick.
So you reverted there,
yes.
Back away from sort of a big idea, pattern recognition,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, being able to really kind of pick up some things that you couldn't otherwise identify as a result of having those records being more complete and for patients having access to them directly,
mm-hmm.
into the more historical legacy value of emergency, sort of break the glass just in case.
Or it doesn't even have to be an emergency.
But I'm going to hone in on it,
okay?
Because it is the traditional use case of why one would need access to their complete records so that when that EMT arrives and they take them to the emergency room, all things can be known and errors avoided, right?
And we were working with
Wait. Okay, let me finish the question.
Yes, yes.
Okay, this is the great thing about sitting with you directly, right? I can look at you in your eye and I can say, hold on a second. So here's the question.
They can't see my hand gestures.
No, they can't, luckily. But I can, and I take them in stride. So here's the question.
Yeah.
How often have people realized the value of online access to a complete medical record in an emergency setting where that care provider would not have otherwise had access to that history? Do we have any sense? Are these anecdotal only still? Because that has been the historical use case.
I don't think we know.
After 15 years, we still
I don't know how often.
No, I'm guessing you're right. I'm guessing you're right. And listeners can tweet or email us and challenge us on this point. But I don't think, other than anecdotal situations,
it doesn't happen. It's just that we don't know what the number
is. That's right. But after 15 years, you and I having been sort of at the forefront of this, you know, we would be probably of the more likely to know, but we don't. And I guess my point is this, is that of all the theoretical value of people having access to their complete health records, what do we really know? I want to actually go back to something that you said, though, and that is picking up patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to see things that you would not have otherwise seen, maybe not by physically looking at your history, but by a system running and looking. And I think that's what's in line with what was stated at Health Data Palooza and something that Todd Park specifically called out. And that is without running algorithms or without looking at the data in deep ways,
mm-hmm.
you're not necessarily going to be able to pick up those signals of importance unless you have it all, right? And so that is one of the big drivers of having more data at the individual level and the aggregate level, right?
But I'm not looking for deep patterns here, Phil.
You're just looking for something.
I'm looking for things that, you know, oh, gee, you know, that really did happen when I stopped taking that medicine. Look what happened to my hemoglobin A1C. It really went up. I don't think these are deep big data kind of things. I think we're
these
looking
are individual.
For, these are individual kind of responses to what's happening.
In fact, let me just make a segue there and say that earlier this morning you were reciting a case to me where you recently went back and saw in 1996 that something had happened in a lab result which has helped advise you today in the care of a patient, right? So that is the value of longitudinal data across the care continuum for the provider to help support the patient.
Well, and for the patient. Yeah,
ah,
that's
go
an interesting
there.
Thing. So it's a really interesting thing is that in all of this discussion about Blue Button and looking at records, you know, the question is how much are we allowing patients to see? How much do patients have access to? So I was able to look back and find that in 1996, this patient had a mildly elevated uric acid level, right? And I was able to look at the note that was associated with that and understand why I sent that uric acid, and we could then look and see if that could be related to the x-rays that he has today. Whatever. The point is that often when we talk about data access for patients, they may not be able to go back a long time. In fact, often what we're talking about is in the view, download, and transmit is let's get access to a piece of the record, my latest visit, what have you.
So do you believe that the sentiment has changed over time from largely being I need my health information, so when I go to a provider, they have access to it, or when I go to an emergency room provider, they have access to it, to allow me to start looking at understanding and maybe picking up some of those patterns myself as a patient? Is the sentiment changing as to the primary driving use case for having longitudinal data?
I am not sure that the primary use case was that before, but I think yes. I think we're talking more about patient understanding today about their own health. So if I want to understand my health, I need to be able to have access to information about my health. What's going on? I want access to the data so that I can understand really what's going on with me.
Okay. So I want to use this as a segue. Okay. So
There is one more thing I want to say. I don't know if you want
to go right ahead. Yeah, we've got about 8 minutes. So
okay.
Go ahead.
Just real quick. I think there is the other huge value in patients accessing their information online is not just about the raw data, but I think there's a huge value in the clinical notes. And let me just make this case very strongly. My patients who are now looking at all through our institution and many institutions, including the VA, patients can access their notes. And one of the huge values there that is not found in any other piece of the record is that's where you're seeing the section of the note that we call the impression and plan or the assessment and plan. That is a list of the patient's active problems and what we're doing about each one. My patient
deciphering. It's a sort of summarization.
It's a summarization. This is the care plan. This is what we're doing together about this. It's a narrative. But my patients have had a huge value in that because then they know what the expectations are of both me and of them, and this is what the plan is. And they may not choose to follow that, and that's okay, but we're writing those things together, by the way, and then they have reference. It's permanent. It's there. So I co-author notes with patients in the office. And so they're part of this. They're agreeing to this. This is the plan. And so they can see that care plan online, and they can choose to execute against it or not. So that's a very important dimension to patients' access to their health records that I don't want to forget about.
Yeah, good. Okay, no, that's a really, really important point. So during Health Data Palooza, Apple announced iOS 8 and HealthKit.
Yeah.
Just to summarize for our audience something they probably already know because of this audience's attention on this issue of health IT. Apple's HealthKit is an API mechanism that they're developing out to work with partners, both system or institutional level partners like Mayo Clinic, as well as technology partners like Epic and wearable technology partners like Nike and others. They have demonstrated the ability to look at your own data that comes from the institutions, such as their medications or lab test results, but also an easy way to look at your wearable data as well. Okay? And so this is just another important development in following what Microsoft and Samsung have already announced, in giving people more direct access to one place to be able to see and interpret their trends, their patterns, their data. And so what I'm wondering is, if you look at these two ecosystems. One's the institutional ecosystem in which you have your EHR and your patient portal, or the Epic installations and MyChart, and then you juxtapose that with these wearable sort of channeling of data into the iPhone, the Samsung, or the Windows Phone device. How do those two ecosystems come together? A lot of people that I've heard talk about this worry about data overload for the clinical setting. How would the care team possibly take advantage of all that data if it's coming in as PGHD? How do you decipher the signal from the noise? Is that even important? If it all stays separate, it's fine, or if it all goes into one place, it's fine. What's your point of view on how those ecosystems come together?
Well, first of all, I think that there is a value in having some monitoring devices. I don't think, contrary to what some people believe, that more information is always better, because there is a lot of noise here, and we can be distracted by the noise, and we can be misled by noise, and we may be drawing inferences to patterns that don't mean anything. In addition, there's a level of accuracy of these devices that just isn't there. This was recently reviewed in a New York Times article where they talked about the fact that they may be directionally correct, but they're not quite correct necessarily in terms of exactly how many footsteps you're taking, how many calories you're burning, that sort of thing. So one issue is the quality of the data. One issue is the volume of the data, and it's what's going to be interesting is whether or not institutions are going to want to bring this data in, certainly not in its raw form because there's just too much of it. There will be a role for some summarization of this information. But I actually wonder whether or not consumer quality devices are ever going to be accepted into our medical records. In fact, the dirty little secret is with all the health information exchange we're doing, we don't even accept information into our records from other records. We may accept a PDF of that information.
Let alone something the patient might
exactly,
say or do.
Exactly. I may be able to see this information, even bring in a PDF of it, but I'm not going to integrate your blood glucoses that were done across town. We don't do that.
God forbid.
God forbid.
That might have been done in a slightly different way.
I know. My goodness, a different essay. So, am I really going to take your Fitbit, your dirty, filthy Fitbit information?
It's been worn on my dirty jeans.
I
How
know.
You
might wear it on your bra or something.
It
was
your bra. you can't accept that data.
I know. So I think this is going to be a really interesting issue. And then, but for medical devices, for things that actually have been tested by the FDA and are valid, glucometer, for example, a blood pressure cuff, what have you, there I think there is a huge opportunity. Still a signal and noise problem. Still we need summarization. But we need to figure out a way to, bring that into medical decision-making or collaborative decision-making so that we can take better care of it.
And that really is the enormous challenge that I heard a lot about at Health Data Palooza. And that is this enormous area that's just starting to emerge and what, many people feel will explode. And that is patient-generated health data, not necessarily just wearable or biometric, not necessarily just patient-reported, but at least patient-sourced.
Yeah.
And that PGHD effort, now officially sort of blessed as a potential future as long as they solidify the plans for meaningful use stage 3 to bring that back into the EHR in some way, shape, or form. So that's a lot of stuff to figure out. Okay. It's a lot of stuff to figure out on how often and in what form this data should come back. It's interesting to note that for all those people that don't trust data that may have come from another source, whether it's the HIE professional data or it's from the patient, that in fact, so much of the health record, and in fact, I would actually suggest the majority, actually did come from somewhere else. It came from a lab that's not in your four walls. It came from the patient's self-reporting of their history or chief complaint or what they said on physical exam. Does it hurt? You record whether it does or not, but they said whether it does
filtered
or not.
Filtered through the clinicians, but you're right. Yeah.
Well, that's right. It's filtered, but it was patient-reported its initial form. If a patient says, I like to say this, of course, I've said it many times, and that is if a patient self-reports that they're allergic to penicillin, the clinician doesn't go, you know what, I don't think so, and I'm going to prescribe it anyway. And so it's a very, very interesting domain. We have 30 seconds left. And so parting words of wisdom on this topic.
I'm going to leave it as a future comment because this would be an interesting comment for the future, which is that physicians are beleaguered today.
Yes.
We have a big challenge with physician rebellion against what they're being asked to do.
And their workflow and data entry challenges.
Non-value-added work. We talked about this a little yesterday with some folks. And this world of patient-generated health data could make this problem worse. And this is, you know, there's a lot of pushback right now.
So the challenge will be to not do that.
Correct.
Yes.
We've got to figure out a way to make this part of the workflow.
And in fact, maybe even patients can offload a lot of the work by doing the important documentation.
You mean we can offload to the patient.
That's right.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. That's right. So with that, great discussion, as always. We could have gone for an hour. We were worried earlier, what are we going to talk about?
We can do this again.
And there's never a problem. So, Greg, turn back over to you, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in.
And that'll be last word on this special edition of This Week in Health Innovation, live from the Health Data Palooza, the just concluded Health Data Palooza. I want to thank Dr. Danny Sands for his time today, this competent stewardship of the interaction between the two of these colleagues by Dr. Phil Marshall. This is Greg Ministers for This Week in Health Innovation. We do this weekly, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Join us next week for another episode of the show. It's Greg Ministers saying bye now.